The society we know, our own culture, is based upon the exchange of women, wrote Lucy Rigare. That world in which women are commodities to be traded by men to further the economic model that is the family is what we call the patriarchy. And women and men are not born but become so through a slow process of repeating gestures of styling our bodies to be feminine, to be masculine. Where do we learn that? Through family, school, society, and by seeing ourselves, our ideal selves, in art. Theatre has a complex relationship to gender norms. On the one hand, it is the textbook of how to be a man, a woman, a husband, a wife, a family, a society. On the other hand, no art form is as open to subverting and questioning these norms more. On theatre stage, there is also drag, burlesque, performance art, voguing, the stages where Nora slammed the door and walked out of her marriage. Queer is everything outside the norm of how to be a man or a woman. It is subversive, but never violent. Queer is a gay man whose t-shirt says dyke. Queer is a femme lesbian. Queer is a single mother. Queer is a man who cries. In the fourth season of Audio Stage, we talk to performers and performance makers about what queer is and isn't, how it exists in theatre, how queer theatre exists in the world, about its political power and its aesthetic urgency. I am Jana Perkovic, and with us today is Matthew Todd. Matthew Todd is a sometimes stand-up comedian and a playwright, that is what your bio says, whose play Blowing Whistles has been described as one of the most popular gay plays of recent times. A long-time editor of the UK gay magazine Attitude, and a person who has actively participated in and helped shape contemporary LGBT culture. Matthew has recently published a stunning book under the title Straight Jacket, How to Be Gay and Happy, in which he takes a critical look behind the shiny facade of this culture. Part memoir, part investigative journalism, and part polemic, the book asks if gay people are as happy as it seems and as happy as they could be. If not, why not? Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for asking me.
So in Audio Stage, we speak with theatre makers on general interest topics, and we don't normally interview book authors. Mm-hmm. But it was not a surprise to find out that you have written for stage and even performed.
A little bit.
Because, as you yourself point out, show business plays a much more central role in the lives of gay people than perhaps the general population. You have a very interesting explanation, shall we say, for it. Could you tell us?
Yeah, I just think when children are traumatized, when the reality becomes too much for them, I think we... And it can be straight people too, you know, anyone who's traumatized. I think I go into the book about why LGBT people are inherently traumatized because we're different and we're treated as being different and other from very early on. And I see it in kids, you know, even when they're like 2 years old, parents kind of go, oh, you shouldn't act like that. You shouldn't be this way. You should be more masculine. You should be more feminine. Boys don't do this. Girls don't do that. So we start absorbing that and it becomes a bit uncomfortable to be who we are. And I think traumatized people look to soothe their distress in different ways. And I think often we do it with food. I think that's probably, you know, a way that people do it a lot in the first place. Kids, I certainly did. And fantasy and entertainment is a big thing. And as we get older, I think it becomes, you know, sometimes it can be manipulative behavior, you know, trying to control things. It's about control, trying to control our feelings so we can try and control other people. Or as we get a bit older, then it becomes alcohol, or it sometimes can be drugs, sometimes can be sex, sometimes can be shopping. But I think very early on, it's for traumatized people and LGBT people, it's entertainment and fantasy. So be it, for me, it was The Wizard of Oz, which is a cliche. But, you know, I didn't know it was a cliche when I was 5 years old. I certainly didn't know I was gay. I wasn't going, oh, I'm going to love this film because I one day I'm going to be a gay man.
So I better brush up on the canon. That's not what you...
No, not at all. In fact, actually, you know, I see quite a lot of young people who, as they get older, they realise that some of the things they have liked growing up are considered to be gay. And I see them then reject those things. And I think, you know, that's a kind of, you know, self-loathing kind of thing to say, you know, oh, well, I can't like musicals because I'm not going to like musicals because gay people like musicals, or I'm not going to like Madonna or Kylie because gay people like Madonna or Kylie. So lots of people do embrace those things and just carry on and unselfconsciously do whatever they do. But I think, yes, I think we can have very intense relationships with certain performers, certain types of entertainment. And then I think it's always things which offer us a kind of big world that can envelop us and that we can disappear into. So fantasy, you know, a lot of gaming actually is becoming a bigger and bigger thing. For me, it was The Wizard of Oz, which makes total sense now. There's a narrative in that, you know, the young child who felt unloved and so went off from this grey world into this colourful world where...
A place where there isn't any trouble.
A place where there isn't any trouble, if only that place existed. And where it's very colourful and sparkly, and then she learns the lessons that she learns and then eventually goes home to find out that to some degree it was in her head and actually she was loved from the beginning and she just needed to appreciate the things that she did have. Which is kind of the message of the book in some ways, that you can overcome these things yourself, that the things that we are looking for are found in ourselves in the end, which sounds like a nonsensical statement, but I think it's actually one of the most profound things for all people, actually, because we're in a culture and a society, certainly the Western culture, which is about looking outside of ourselves for quick fixes and stimulation and sex, drugs, alcohol, entertainment. I mean, you know, phones. We're all addicted to our phones. I think that's a troubling thing, me included. So I think it's interesting that, of course, you know, everybody likes entertainment, but it's really interesting to me that, you know, my straight friends do not engage with pop culture the way my gay friends do. Mm. You know, my straight friends do not have, you know, famous performers as their Facebook profile pictures, as some of my gay friends do. Mm. You know, when Lady Gaga's new single came out, and I love Lady Gaga, she's my favorite at the moment. I don't imagine the straight world, you know, of my 40-year-old straight friends were quite as excited about that as my gay friends were.
It's a sort of cultural currency.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you go to bars and there's some drag queen pretending to be Liza Minnelli or now Britney or whoever it may be.
Yeah. Do you think that's why in the performing arts a lot of people who work there are queer?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I remember years ago thinking, because I was drawn to the theatre when I was younger, and my mum and dad would take me to the theatre a lot and I'd see musicals. I was obsessed with Starlight Express, the train, Andrew Lloyd Webber train show that was here like the 84 or something, and then Phantom of the Opera. I was obsessed with that. And I thought for a while when I started kind of, you know, working a little bit around theatre that maybe gay people were attracted to it because it was a safe place. And I think maybe that's part of it, but actually quite a small part, actually. I think it's just because we're attracted to that world, that artifice, the escape, the place where you're getting a lot of attention. I mean, I think, you know, most performers and lots of creative people are really troubled people. We, you know, have these issues, mental health problems, depression, anxiety, all the rest of it. And I think that all that stuff comes part and parcel of being overly sensitive and wanting to fix ourselves by getting attention. Go on.
And that offers very easy affirmation.
Absolutely. It's all about getting validation, outside validation, and making yourself feel good from other people. So outside esteem, be with the people giving you a round of applause or casting you as the lead or whatever it may be, just being in the spotlight. I mean, that Lady Gaga single, Applause, I live for the applause. I mean, that says it all. I think it's really fascinating that when you see... I was talking to Will Young, actually. You know Will Young, the singer? Talking to him about the book and in a podcast that he was doing. And I was just saying, you know, it's really interesting. There's a disproportionate number of LGBT people you see on these talent shows, like The X Factor. Completely forgetting that's how Will came about himself from Pop Idol. So, you know, you always see these slightly vulnerable, sometimes desperate, and, you know, slightly pained gay people coming out and trying to belt out a song, and sometimes they're great and sometimes they're not so great like everybody else. And I did it myself. I remember I auditioned for Rent years ago, the Rent the musical, and was completely useless and it was absolutely horrendous. But it was when I look back now, it was an interesting experience, you know, that I need, you know, it was an expression of wanting to be liked and to be part of something.
Mm.
So when we come to gay plays, I think maybe there was such censorship in the 70s and 80s and maybe 90s And that because gay lives weren't reflected on TV or in cinema, I think people turned to the theatre to express themselves. And I think, you know, I think theatre producers, or certainly fringe producers, were often gay, or if they were straight, they were very open to queer content. So I think a lot of the time we were telling our stories in the theatre. And people, in a way, I think sometimes people have written gay work as a kind of therapy, you know, to get their thoughts and feelings out there on stage. And some of those things have been great, and some of them have not been so great, because there's a lot of things just being flung against the wall and just to see whatever kind of stuck. So often I would go and see plays where, like you say, someone always takes the clothes off, which means an audience will always come to see it, a male audience. And often they weren't very good. And I always remember feeling a little bit, certainly when I was growing up, I had an overwhelming feeling of thinking, there's something about gay culture for me that wasn't working. You know, I'd grown up feeling isolated and ashamed and not part of the mainstream, not part of a heterosexual world, and thought when I came out, I would be surrounded by love and, you know, happiness and joy and support and everyone being nice to each other. And that wasn't what I found. It was a lot of dysfunction, a lot of craziness, a lot of people not being very nice to each other, a lot of kind of objectification, which, you know, I've done a lot of that myself in Attitude, but you know, it didn't feel like a massively healthy place. And I think that was expressed through gay theatre sometimes. And I would see these plays where it was almost like the author was kind of having a little nod and a wink to the audience. It was, you know, kind of using maybe, I don't know, gay specific jargon or, you know, maybe sexual jargon, and the kind of a nod and a wink to the audience that maybe straight people wouldn't get. And for once we've got our time, and isn't it great? We're waving the flag, and the kind of lesson was always, you know, we're oppressed, but actually we're fabulous, and sometimes we're better than everybody else, and screw the mainstream. And that's fine, but I felt like we weren't addressing some of our own problems. So when I wrote Blowing Whistles, the first half, it got a really bad review in The Guardian, actually. She said it was an adult sex comedy, or sitcom, or something like that, an adult sitcom, which really annoyed me, because I feel like she missed the point of it. The first half, it's about a couple who have a third person in off of Gaydar, which was the website that everyone used at the time. I've rewritten it now for Grindr, actually, and about how it affects their relationship over the course of a weekend. And the first half was meant to be a pastiche of these kind of gay plays where it was a little bit saucy, someone takes the clothes off, it's a bit sexual, it's a bit of a knowingness between, you know, what's going on stage and the audience, you know, like we can talk about these things, all the boys together. But the second half was a kind of attack on that culture. So it's complicated, because sometimes I think, you know, I haven't got a problem to some degree hearing the term gay play, because at least it makes me think, oh, that's a story about gay characters, and I will go and see it. But my friend Paul Keating, who was in Blowing Whistles when we did it in Leicester Square in 2008, he's in a play at the moment, Kenny Morgan, I can't remember where it's at now, which is really bad of me, but somewhere in East London, the Arcola Theatre, and it's a great play about Terence Rattigan and his big gay relationship, which inspired the play The Deep Blue Sea. He's really hates the term gay play, because he feels it's used as a kind of way of demoting the work and saying it's only appropriate for gay people, and if you're straight you shouldn't come and see it. Yeah. And I think that's the problem that I just think, you know,
so the gay play is the subset of play, and
yeah,
the play is heterosexual.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's really difficult. I mean, I think I'm surprised my experience with the book has just made me realise how massively, I mean, and this is a naive thing to say, but how massively heterosexual the world is, and how difficult it is if you are a, you know, LGBT person to have mainstream success. It's really, really, really hard. And it's all on straight people's terms. It's what they deem to be worthy of taking out of, you know, the fringe and put in the mainstream or in the West End. It's what they decide is good. You know, there's a lot of kind of like low-key homophobia. It's not hatred, but it's a lack of interest and a lack of respect. But that's where we are. That's where we're at, unfortunately.
So it sounds to me like when you're describing the gay play, it's this sort of small part of the gay culture that we could term, or narrative culture that we could term, gay realism, you know, as opposed to the drag and the kind of excess of a lot of gay art or queer art.
What do you mean in terms of, as opposed to kind of like cabaret performances, so actually telling people, talking about people's lives?
As opposed to burlesque, as opposed to cabaret, exactly, as opposed to drag, as opposed to a lot of sort of rather kind of fantastical art that is sort of accepted as this is what queer people should do. You know, they should be fun and it should be very witty and over the top.
Oh, God. Yeah, you know? See, I'm about over all of that. I find it that kind of draggy. Sometimes I can really like drag. If it's saying something intelligent or provocative or with something with meaning, it's great. But to me, it's not enough to just dress up as a woman and pretend you're a woman and be mouthy and gobby and rude and put people down. That's not interesting to me. I hate to say it. I just think we need to be more than that. I mean, maybe it's partly my age because I'm 42 now, and I'm sure I probably liked it when I was 20. But actually, to be honest, I don't know if I did. There's a tradition of drag here, which there were performers like in pubs like the Black Cap, which aren't open anymore. There was a drag queen called Regina Fong, who was really important during the 80s in terms of, you know, gay pubs were community centres then and support centres really during HIV and AIDS at that worst time of it. And people like Regina Fong and Lily Savage really brought the community together. And Regina would kind of mime to tapes. She did this song called Skippy the Kangaroo, which got everyone singing Skippy, Skippy. And this typewriter song where she would play the typewriter. And it was ridiculous, but it was really good fun. And it was really engaging and it felt communicative. And that was great. But there's great people like Dickie Bow here. I don't know if you know Dickie Bow. He kind of... It's proper art what he does. It's, you know, some people, I think he, I can't remember what he calls himself now, but he kind of mimes to snippets of old interviews with Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe, but it's not about comedy, it's more about pathos and drama. There's people like David Hoyle, who is amazing, who's incredibly radical and not for everybody, but, you know, is a really provocative artist who's far more than what you might expect out of, you know, that kind of whole drag scene.
Reading your book, I was struck by I suppose the realism of it, I suppose, you know, that readiness to say, you know, maybe the world is this way and maybe we're sort of not talking about some really, really obvious things. Like it opens with a harrowing BBC radio interview that was done in 1967 with a gay man who is sort of presented as a freak, really, and he speaks about how he's not interested in sort of cruising public toilets for sex and how he'd actually like to just have a companion, and he doesn't think that it's possible. And what comes across is this real sense of tragedy, like a real sense of impossibility for this man to have a normal life. And throughout your book, you keep returning to this historical fact that we sort of keep sweeping under the carpet, that being gay was criminal and practically almost impossible until really very recently. And it seems that both the mainstream and the queer culture are currently pretending that sort of never happened. That we were always just kind of liberated and happy and cooler than anyone else.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a certain kind of demand, external and internal, for that narrative?
Yes, I think it's. I mean, I would imagine. I mean, I'm not black, but so I can't say for sure. But you know, I can imagine there are similar parallels there. You know, you sometimes hear people, and so maybe with women. You know, I heard someone the other day saying, "Well, women, they've got rights now. They should just shut up, stop moaning about it." And you hear people a lot saying that about, you know, racism. That, you know, black people. You know, what do they want? They've got Obama. Shut up. And I think that there's some truth, for gay people in that respect. Maybe that you know, straight people don't understand what it's like. And I don't think we understand that they don't understand, you know, because we all have our own identities and our own experiences. I don't know what it's like to be straight and have two kids. And I know from family members that can be really difficult. You know, that has its own problems too. We all have problems, don't we? But I certainly think it troubles me that there's lots of young gay people that don't respect where we've come from and how hard it has been to get where we are. And
until
many,
very recently.
Yeah, until, I mean, you know, and obviously it's still a work in progress, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, I had quite a lot of young people, a few young people here at Attitude saying to me, why are you writing the book? Or why are you going on about Section 28, which was the law in the 80s that stopped, banned the so-called promotion of homosexuality in schools, which basically stopped teachers from being able to deal with homophobic bullying. It was horrendous and I really suffered because of it. And that they kind of say, you know, why are you moaning about the fact that, the Conservative government in the 80s was so incredibly homophobic and the media was so incredibly homophobic? And it's been quite gratifying to me, actually, to see some of the reaction to the book that young people say, oh, my God, I never knew that happened. I never knew, you know, that the press were basically saying, if you're gay, go and kill yourself. And they said that in The Sun at one point with a cartoon of a man hanging his young gay son. And when Freddie Mercury was diagnosed with AIDS, the Daily Star said, "Serves you right, Freddie." You know, it was really, really horrendous. And I think partly it's just too painful. I think it's just too painful to think that that's how we were treated. And I think probably, I imagine, I certainly speak for myself, that, you know, there's a residual part of me somewhere in there that still thinks that, you know, intellectually I don't, but that has been kind of forced into me and it's in there somewhere. So to acknowledge that triggers that part and makes me feel that part and makes me feel, you know, not great about myself. Oh my God, am I disgusting? Am I dirty? Am I this? Am I that? Can I ever have a relationship? All that kind of stuff. So it's just much easier to not talk about it and to sweep it under the carpet. But unfortunately, it comes back up to bite you. And I think that's why we have, certainly in London, a huge drug problem with men injecting drugs. And I know that Australia has that to some degree too. And
you say that to be part of the gay community, queer community today, is to be part of a community in which almost everyone is traumatized.
Yeah.
Which is a very rare kind of situation to be in. So if it's not because they have survived the AIDS epidemic, then, you know, maybe your parents have thrown you out of your home when you came out. And if it's not this experience of severe structural oppression, then maybe it's bullying at school. But everyone carries trauma. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, it's just that we all have that same experience. You know, up until a while back, I used to think, well, the one thing that unites us is sex, which is why so much of gay... Well, I used to think, which was the reason why so much of gay culture is about sex, because ultimately we can come from different classes, you know, gay people all over the world, but the one thing we have in common is the fact that we're attracted to people of the same sex. But I don't think that's the case. I think the real thing that unifies us is that unless you are freakishly lucky, you grow up hiding yourself, feeling you cannot be yourself, suppressing your mannerisms and the way you are and the things you say and the way you walk and the way you talk and all those kind of things. And we see it now, you know, we see some of that on apps like Grindr, where men are obsessed with mask for mask and they're, you know, absolutely do not speak to me unless you are hypermasculine, which is a bit strange. But I understand it. You know, when you've been told to be a man and to not be mask is a terrible, terrible... I think that may get you killed, in fact. And it does get you killed still around the world. You know, people still get... There's a guy, I think it was 2008, and maybe it was before that, Ian Bainham, who was stamped to death in Trafalgar Square by some kids. And there's, you know, homophobic murders all over the world, aren't there? So, yes, I think, you know, we come out into the gay scene thinking, oh, we've got this moment of liberation, when in fact we are people who have grown up, you know, shamed, traumatized, and we deal with that. We might not even know it. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't really think about it. And so we're just a whole group of people swirling around together, trying to get on with our lives, not knowing that we've been traumatized.
And everyone has an overactive sort of fight or flight impulse.
Yes, everyone's kind of on edge, maybe a little bit, and dulling some of that with alcohol, sometimes drugs, sometimes sex. Certainly with gay men, it's, you know, a lot of us, we use sex as a way to just make, you know, get validation and dull some of those painful feelings. But none of us know. I don't think we know this. I don't think we knew it. I certainly didn't know it until I went into recovery and stopped drinking. And I'm not saying it's everybody, but I think it's a lot of us.
You build a very interesting, and I'd love you to talk a little bit about this, you draw a very interesting sort of theoretical image of addiction, all sorts of addiction,
mm-hmm.
And being shamed in childhood or trauma, where you suggested addiction, and that might be food, might be sex, it might be love, might be alcohol or drugs or any number of or drama, any number of things, as a way to simply contain, control, pacify these painful feelings that people carry around with them. If you could, and you bring in to that attachment theory, it's a very interesting, it's very interesting what you have to say. If you could,
Yeah, I mean, it's just that, as I said before, if you're traumatized, and it can, of course, it can happen and does happen to huge numbers of straight people, and also as gay people, LGBT people, we can have other forms of trauma and abuse on top of that. So it might be that your parents divorce, or it might be that you get beaten up by your parents, or it might be, you know, any number, or you're living in poverty. There can be a whole wide range of things that happen, and I think I don't understand for sure, but I think there's the part I think. Being so hypervigilant when we're young and aware of how we are, I think that affects the way our brains develop in terms of being more sensitive. And I think we can become hypersensitive to different things and possible slights and people saying unpleasant things to us that other people might just shrug off. But we go, oh my God, it's evidence that I'm a terrible, terrible, unlovable human being. And I think we use lots of different things. I think there's more and more understanding, although I don't think the mainstream health practitioners really understand what addiction is. I certainly didn't, and you know, met lots of people, even though I was clearly drinking too much. No one in the NHS, not the therapist, not the doctors, even though I had a problematic liver function tests, no one said, oh, I wonder if you've got a serious problem with drinking. And I couldn't see it. So we may use alcohol, because anything that changes our mood, so alcohol changes your mood. You know, you have a drink, you have that moment, two or three drinks where you feel happy and you feel great. After that, it might not feel so great. And then the next day, you don't feel so great. Drugs, that sends you sky high until you have the come down. Sex, that's validating. You know, if someone is attracted to you, that makes you feel good, whoever you are. And having sex releases endorphins, so you can see where people might want to do that. Food is the same. Bitching, you know, hurting people is totally a thing that makes you feel better. I mean, and I have to say, you know, it's something that I have struggled with, certainly growing up, you know, always needing to be the person that, you know, got the validation from the teacher, or, you know, someone else's birthday when I was a kid and I didn't feel comfortable with, you know, them getting all the attention. And I think, you know, it's a common thing amongst gay men, isn't it? You know, with the idea of, I remember when I saw the play of Holding the Man, there's a scene in that play where, it's not in the film, but where they're in a bar and there's the kind of gaggle of gay guys going, Judy, 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 Liza, 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 and just being nasty to everybody. And we all know that. We all see that. We can all relate to that because it's a problem. We do have that as a problem. Because being unpleasant, putting somebody else down, makes you feel better temporarily. But there's always a payoff, because underneath it all, you don't feel good about yourself. So all of these things, shopping, you know, I sometimes, when I go into WH Smith's, which is a news agents, they're a big one at Victoria Station, when I'm coming from visiting family, I'll go in there and I'll buy three books because they're on offer and I never read them. And I will buy DVDs and never watch them, because you get some kind of hit from buying those things. And you see it in really famous addicts like Michael Jackson and Elton John. Addict plus lots of money equals a huge spending spree. You know, they're both famous. Mm. They're both famous for just spending, spending, spending. So, yes, that's how we medicate our feelings, but it always comes with a payoff, because if you drink too much, it will start affecting your life. If you take drugs too much, it starts affecting your life. If you have sex too much, I think it starts affecting your life. And that's a very controversial thing to talk about, especially amongst gay culture, gay male culture, because we've used sex to define who we are.
Absolutely. You write about that in your book, about how hard it is to be taken seriously for sex addiction, because we're all supposed to be sex positive today.
Yeah. Yeah, my favourite phrase, sex positivity. I have found that phrase to be really oppressive. Because I had a problem, you know, I was sleeping with too many people and my sexual behaviour was out of control. And it wasn't, you know, me going, oh, you're not allowed to have sex, it's a terrible thing. But it was getting in the way of my life. You know, I wasn't seeing friends, I was spending weekends chasing people around online. I won't get into all of it, but, you know, it was definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, making my life unmanageable. And I would go to sexual health clinics and ask for help, and no one could give me any answers. No answer at all.
Because people said, no, it's good.
Yeah. There was one specific time, which I write about in the book, where a gay sexual health person said to me, you can't have too much sex. It's great. That's, you know, you're gay. That's what we do. Just enjoy it. And that was really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. I was really even more confused and really depressed because I just couldn't get control of what I was doing. And just felt like maybe I'm the only person in the world that feels this way. And I feel like, you know, I got massive frustrations that here we've had this developing drugs problem over the last 15 years, and there've been some people approaching the sexual health agencies, and there's the Terence Higgins Trust here, and gay media saying there's a problem. Mm-hmm. But because they feel they cannot say some of this behaviour might be problematic, they just left it. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse, and people are dying. I mean, someone died this week, I think was a drugs thing. You know, you just see it on Facebook all the time. You know, I've known people that have died or overdosed. It's become this huge problem, and it's shameful, really, that we've allowed it to get this far. So I'm up for challenging sex positivity. It's not about shaming people or saying sex is wrong. It's not at all, but it's about acknowledging that sometimes you can use sex as self-harm. And I think that's 100% true.
There is a kind of reluctance to suggest that some parts of the gay culture, empirical gay culture, might be damaging because, I don't know, it is seen as homophobic, perhaps.
It's because we've been told, we've been shamed and told all gay sexual behaviour is wrong for so long. So instead of being nuanced, we've kind of thrown the baby out with the bathwater and said, no, all gay sexual behaviour is right in every circumstance and situation. It's interesting to think about issues of consent. You know, there's the stuff I left out of the book, lots of talk of rapes and sexual assaults, and it's almost like we just don't have the vocabulary to even deal with that, to say that perhaps there's a problem, you know, and that there are really terrible things happening. And again, because it feels like the gay media to some degree, or gay voices, or the gay structure here is so on guard, so constantly trying to present this positive image. I don't even know who is to anymore. That to talk about the bad things is not possible.
Now, your play Blowing Whistles,
yes,
which I haven't seen, unfortunately, or read, but it was praised as sort of both fulfilling and rising beyond the conventions of something called the gay play, which I didn't know existed. What is the gay play, or what was the gay play?
I can't remember who reading that saying it. Well, I mean, I think there's a kind of...
It comes up again in reviews.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a number of people who... And I have to say that I really am not sure what they mean. This is, I think... gay men that are theatre critics and that go to see a certain kind of theatre a lot, but they talk about how there is the naked scene, you know, and some other sort of cornerstones of the genre, it seems, but I...
Normally they're not very good, I think, is quite common. I mean, in a way, that phrase gay play is so complex because some people are really offended by it and some people embrace it. And, you know, I think it can be useful just in terms of getting an audience, just telling an audience, because the gay audience certainly now are not as loyal as they might be. They don't feel the need to come out and support, be it a gay book or a gay play or even a gay magazine or a gay TV show or whatever it may be, because we're evolving and we don't need to hunt those things out perhaps quite as much. I mean, that's a good thing in some ways, but also it's a sad thing for artists and writers and performers because, you know, people struggle to have their work seen. Even me as an author with this book, you know, it's been quite hard getting people to review it or to take it seriously or maybe to get a bigger distribution. You know, we do live in a very heteronormative world and there's still massive problems. It might seem that, you know, it's not the case, but, you know, even though a lot of people are talking about my book at the moment and it's getting great reviews and Elton John said every gay person on the planet should read it, it's actually quite hard to to get it outside of some of the major bookshops. I mean, Waterstones are great, but even my local bookshop, they had two copies. They sold out in the first week, and they haven't had any since. So there's still these problems.
I remember when the Vice documentary Chemsex came out, which was really this year, I think, or late last year. My friend Byron Beige, who is a gay man and a theatre critic in Australia, he said to me, and I wrote down his exact words, "You do not want to see Chemsex. It is a bad, mean, ugly film. I hated it." And yet, Byron is someone who has written publicly about his struggles with mental health, and who has told me that it is actually really important for him to talk about that publicly, to talk about his failures publicly. And yet, something like Chemsex, which is exactly that thing, except not personal, he found, I think he felt sort of offended by it, I suppose.
Well, I mean, I don't know him. I've never heard of him. But, you know,
I think
bless
this has
him.
Been a
it's
common reaction.
We none of us liked. I noticed that Chemsex got a lot of negative reactions in Australia. It didn't here, but in Australia, I noticed that there were some really vocal voices attacking it. Which, you know, when you hold a mirror up to people and you don't feel good about, you know, what's in that mirror, then people attack. But I think we need to wake up and we need to grow up. And I know how painful it is. It is really painful. It's excruciatingly painful. But we need to understand it's not okay to go around. You know, there's a young man I know who's in his 20s who has been injecting crystal meth over the last year, and he's caught HIV and he's caught hepatitis C. He's been suicidal. I don't know how he's going to get out of the spiral. You know, the people are trying to help him, but, you know, until you want that help yourself, he's one of many cases. I mean, I've known scores of people like that. It's a horrendous situation. There's nothing positive or sex positive about it. There's nothing to be proud of. It's not about shaming people, but we can't go under this kind of misconception that, you know, whatever we do is okay. You know, if we're hurting ourselves and killing ourselves, that's a problem.
I mean, anyone that has regular contact with gay culture, and particularly male gay culture. I mean, the lesbian community is a different kettle of fish almost entirely. Notices that there is a drug problem collectively. Mm. And for me, for example, realizing how much rape there is in the gay male community came as a huge surprise, because no one ever talks about it. And I'm not entirely sure how we're supposed to solve problems if we're not allowed to say that they exist.
Mm. Well, absolutely, yeah. Mm. I mean, you know, when my book came out in June, I kind of thought, oh my God, everybody's going to read it. You know, it's going to sell a million copies overnight and we're all going to change and everyone's going to go into recovery. And that hasn't happened. I mean, it's selling well, but, you know, it's something that is very, very painful and very difficult to talk about. And also it's very painful to get into recovery. You know, I know myself, it's taken me 9 years of, you know, skirting around, dipping in, dipping out, coming back, stopping drinking, then starting again, and all the different things that I've had to do. You know, dealing with these innermost kind of childhood kind of problems is probably the most painful thing you'll ever do in your life. I really do think that that's the truth. But it's also the most worthwhile thing you can ever do in your life, and the best thing you can ever do.
What is the role of queer media, and here I mean art and media in the most general sense, in this mess? Here we are sitting in the Attitude offices surrounded with queer diversity, and I know that one thing you are particularly proud of is your work as editor here on reflecting the real diversity of queer lives and body types and careers and experiences in the magazine. What is the sort of media representation that you think we need?
Well, it's complicated, because thank you for saying that, but a lot of people would disagree and say that Attitude doesn't reflect diversity, you know, but it's something I have tried to address in my editorship, and I've become editorial director this June, so my last issue was our Prince William issue. Unfortunately, the reality is the only thing that the readers support regularly is a sexy cover. So be it some pop star with the shirt off or a model with the shirt off, whatever it may be. Now, everybody moans about that. People moan about that a lot. Years ago, when I first took over, someone said to me, "Attitude, you're all body fascists. You're making us all feel bad about our bodies. You'd never put Stephen Fry on the cover." So I did put Stephen Fry on the cover, and it was the lowest selling issue ever. And my boss shouted at me and became the closest he ever has done to firing me. So that, but we have continued to do that. It's been important to me. You know, I put Beth Ditto on the cover, was the Ashley's first lesbian cover star. We've had the first out gay black man on the cover of Attitude as an Attitude cover star, not the first out gay black man in the world. And, you know, with the first trans person on our cover, the first Asian man on our cover, the first gay Asian man, the second lesbian. You know, I've tried and tried and tried. But those covers don't tend to do well. So it's really difficult because ultimately, you know, the readers of a magazine, most people don't take these issues that we're talking about out into their everyday to day life. Essentially, if you're buying a magazine at a newsstand, you want a magazine either that's, you know, it's just human nature, a sexy cover star for everybody, straight people, whatever, that's what makes magazines sell, or something you want to buy if it's a different type of magazine. So I've tried to mix it up as much as we can here, and some of the things we've done are great. Like we've got our Attitude Pride Awards cover.
I'm quite happy with that.
We did this awards event 18 months ago with 12 community activists on the cover. So, you know, like a guy who was 92, who's calls himself the oldest gay in the village, who, you know, grew up through the time when it was illegal and now goes to gay pride events, and Asifa Lahore, the UK's first Muslim drag queen, a guy who was with the original lesbians and gays support the minors. So all these, and a trans activist, and lots of different types of people. And I'm really proud of that. But again, it wasn't an issue that sold very well. It's not an issue that I think most people think of when they think of Attitude. They just think of the sexy hunks, and because that's what they buy. So gay media, you know, I think gay media all over, certainly over the Western world, is struggling a little bit, I think, because we're in this transitionary period where, you know, in the 80s and 90s, because mainstream media was so homophobic and so completely heterosexual, gay people had a, you know, very specific need to go out and read about their lives in gay magazines. And as that's changed slightly, and there's more gay people on TV and more gay storylines and more gay writers in mainstream media, and not that there's a huge amount, that need is has lessened, I think. And also just the fact that because of the internet, you know, people see people don't need to go hunting for magazines to get information. We can go and look at 1,000 articles in an hour or something.
Do you think that, though, that there still might be a shortage of realism?
I mean, I think in the media, yes, absolutely.
I mean, on every level.
Yeah, and I think my experience of promoting this book, for instance, you know, we did Prince William on the cover, and we took 10 LGBT people to Kensington Palace to meet him to talk about bullying, LGBT phobic bullying. And they had some horrendous stories. It's a really important issue that doesn't get talked about very much. And I was absolutely delighted and really excited about it because I thought, great, we're going to put this issue into the mainstream. The press will report it because it's Prince William and they'll talk about all of the issues and the bullying. And all they did was talk about him being a royal and a celebrity. And they said, oh, Attitude's done David Beckham before. They didn't really touch on the bullying and the reason why we did it. And I think, you know, as I was saying earlier, we live in this heterosexual, heteronormative world where a lot of people are very gay friendly in the media now, but on their terms of their experience, what's interesting to their, what they see as their audience, which they see as simply straight people. Like, I just did this big radio program here, very famous British radio program, and I was very excited to go on it, and I'm very grateful they had me on it. But they didn't want to talk about what I wanted to talk about, which was this crisis in mental health. They just wanted to talk about what advice would you give mothers who have gay kids, which is valid, but it's not what that's not the pressing, urgent message that I have. So, yeah, it's very difficult to see real lives reflected properly. I mean, actually, I was watching EastEnders last night and thinking that soaps have done an incredible job, actually. I think they've actually been, like, in terms of the media, they've been the number one thing that's actually really educated people because they have massive audiences. They show, you know, a heightened reality, don't they, obviously, but they are the closest thing to some kind of reality and normality that, that people see of people and gay people.
Well, because they're not one act sort of tragedies.
Yeah, they're ongoing and you know the characters and you see the relationships. I mean, loads of them get things wrong, but, you know, certainly in EastEnders, they've got so many gay characters now. It's incredible. And it's actually very, just very normal, and it sort of feels really healthy, which is a great thing.
Yes, I remember the first time, this was maybe 10, 15 years ago now, when a friend of mine said, you know, it was so nice to see that first lesbian movie where they just survived. They made it to the end of the film.
Yeah, what a terrible thing, though, isn't it, that we still have that? And, you know, if you think about it...
I mean, it still has to be Brokeback Mountain that will win all the awards, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I love Brokeback Mountain, but again, it's a very, you know, and I think it's a really important film, but, you know, what I would love to see with actors like them, you know, proper A-list Hollywood actors, a lovely gay romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. I just saw Bridget Jones's Baby the other day, and I hated myself for buying into it, but it was really fun. It's a bit of fluff, but I was just, you never get that with same-sex characters, and wouldn't it just be nice? There was Weekend, but even that, I mean, I think Weekend is great, but it's still essentially an art house film, isn't it? It's not something you slam on for a nice, lovely Saturday night feel good. And of course, a gay rom-com made by Hollywood maybe wouldn't be the most commercially viable film in the world, but everyone thought that about Brokeback Mountain, so, you know, get James Franco, I'm sure he'd be up for it, and hook him up with some other handsome actor, or, you know, we had Blue is the Warmest Colour, didn't we? But again, there's still it's an art film, isn't it? So, or an art house film. So, you know, just it would be nice to have. And actually, I'm sure some queer people don't want mainstream, you know.
But doesn't it always start in the art house cinema?
Oh yeah, I think art house films are amazing. I mean, Brokeback Mountain, Blue, and all these different films that I saw when I was growing up, they're all incredible. But it just would be nice to be in the mainstream too, and not to be like, I saw Sausage Party the other day, you know, the Seth Rogen kind of animation thing about kind of products in a supermarket. It's a silly, like, gross out kind of boys kind of comedy where the sausages come to life and all the rest of it, all the food comes to life. But it just was interesting that there was a joke about the fruit being them being the gay men, and it was it wasn't offensive, it was quite sweet in its intentions. But again, it was always like this kind of lisping kind of, come on, boys, we're the fruit, you know. It just is irritating that I was thinking, actually, you know, I am a little bit effeminate and that's fine for me, but I actually know loads of really, you know, gay men that don't talk with a lisp, you know, that are just as macho as the next guy. So it's complicated, isn't it? It's really complicated.
Will you describe in that sort of toxic combination of depending on validation for self-esteem and getting it, you know, working to get it, but not quite sort of feeling it inside and sort of cycles of addiction, you basically describe something that is quite close to clinical narcissism. And in fact, you quote The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller, which was, I think, anecdotally to be titled The Drama of the Narcissistic Child, but then she changed the title because she said no one would buy it. And that's quite interesting because people who work in show business tend to score very highly on narcissism. you know, this is there's a lot of corroborating evidence there on that. And I teach at a performing arts conservatorium, and so naturally I teach a lot of young gay men, at the age of 19, 20, 21, who are often at that age only just coming to terms with their sexuality, as they would, and they're coming to terms with their sexuality in the context of the entertainment profession, which is quite narcissistic. It is also promiscuous. It is naturally very focused on appearance, because they're often studying to be actors, or in any case performers. Even if they're going to make a theatre, they're going to perform in it. And it is in that context that we discuss gender theory, you know, that we discuss race theory. We discuss how theatre gives us both the image of what is normal and normative, and what is possible. you know, that you can do the most outrageous thing as long as you do it on stage, and you're safer on stage than if you're walking home in the same costume.
Yeah.
But then, for example, if they want to do Shakespeare, or if they want to do Chekhov, if they want to do Ibsen, then they have to play it straight. And I watch these young men, you know, struggle to come to terms with, you know, to accept themselves, to sort of come out to their peers, and at the same time, immediately they have to work with the fact that they're going to represent men.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. men. And I've had more than one student say to me, if in order to play a Chekhov character, I sort of have to wash off my body all queerness, so that someone, you know, my friends, when they see me, they can say, wow, you know, you played it, you were so heterosexual. Mm. Then I'm showing to another generation of gay men coming up that a real man is not what they are, that a real man is something else. And they really struggle with that. They struggle with the agency and sort of limitations of their position. What would you say to them? Because every year I have to say something to them on that topic, and I never really know what to say.
I don't think I know either. I mean, I think these are kind of actually, I think, you know, these are really huge questions. You know, I do think there are, being gay is more complicated than we have kind of thought. You know, I think, you know, there's been a kind of narrative which is kind of like, which I think young people have used to, as we've all tried to say, you know, we want to say to young people, it's okay to be gay, you don't have to feel terrible about it. And I think that's a good thing, and that's great. And we've kind of presented it as if it's just like, you know, some people have blue eyes, some people have brown eyes. And I actually do think it's more complicated than that, because, you know, I would, if I was playing, you know, I still have some aspirations to go back into doing stand-up and maybe acting. But if I'm being honest, you know, it's like Harvey Fierstein. I would find it quite difficult, to some degree, to see Harvey Fierstein as a heterosexual male lead. Maybe because I recognise him. He's got such a distinctive voice. I don't know if you know him. Like, he's in Mrs. Doubtfire. He's got, hi, I'm Harvey. He speaks like that. He's incredible. He's like wrote Torch on Trilogy, first ever big gay play on Broadway. I have seen him play characters which may have been heterosexual, but I think it's kind of to some degree about, well, if you want to call it campiness or whatever. Like, you know, there are some, I mean, I can think of a handful of actors, quite successful actors, Hollywood actors, who are gay but are playing, you know, heterosexual male leads. But I do think that that's because they are subduing that kind of queer, effeminate, whatever you want to call it, that side of themselves. And that they will be very, very conscious of that and very careful to not be presenting that. And I think perhaps, you know, I would love it if, you know, some big gay, effeminate guy could, you know, be playing opposite Julia Roberts in, I don't know, the Pretty Woman sequel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that will happen. I think part of our, where we're at now, is to some degree maybe accepting that we are different, actually, and we are different. I think to be LGBT is really different, actually, and I think that goes against the grain of what we've been thinking over the last 10 or 15 years, that it's exactly the same. And I just don't believe that it is the same. You know, even if you go into a gay bar, it's very different from going into a straight bar. Mm. The way people behave, the way people look sometimes, you know, just the way people dress. You know, we are different. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think if we can't maybe think about that and investigate that and ultimately accept that, how can we feel okay in ourselves? So maybe, you know, the reality is, as me as a slightly, you know, effeminate guy, I'm not going to be cast as the male, you know, the heterosexual male lead in some play. You know, it's going to be somebody else. You know, it's going to be a guy that does that rightly or wrongly. That's just the way it's going to be. Maybe we will evolve over the next 200 years and everything will be different. But I don't know. And that's why sometimes people say to me, oh, you know, your book is about, you know, growing up in the time of HIV and AIDS in the 80s and the homophobia. It won't be the same now. The young people won't have the same trauma. But that's not my experience of the young people I meet and the young people I've interviewed. You know, accepting you are different is quite a big problem for a lot of people. It's a huge thing. You know, our lives are different. If I was to I'm single, sadly, but if I was to go traveling and I had a partner, I would have to really think about which countries I was going to. Even in this country, you know, there's been bed and breakfasts where they have not allowed gay couple to stay in the same room. There was a big case here in Northern Ireland where a bakery refused to ice a cake with a gay slogan. You know, there are complications. And, you know, this kind of hypervigilance we have about, even in London, you know, like saying goodbye to a friend on the street. Some places I will do that, with a hug and a kiss, and some places I won't do that. And if I get onto a bus, I'm always a little bit conscious of is there anyone scary on this bus who may not pick up on the fact that I'm gay and may not like it. And that's part of my own issue, you know, that I think about that when I don't need to. You know, we can do that too. Someone didn't open the door for me, like slammed a door in my face the other day, and I remember thinking, is it because I'm gay? And I had to stop and think, oh my God, that's interesting. You know, that's maybe not the healthiest reaction for me. You know, maybe it's just someone rude, maybe it's someone in a rush. Maybe they didn't like the look of me. Maybe they didn't have any thought about it. Or maybe they did. Maybe they did think, I hate that gay, needs a door slammed in his face. I don't know, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I need to work on my own stuff about not being so sensitive. It's very complicated, and I think maybe this is where we go next. Certainly is for me. I think we need to talk about these things and help each other come to terms with all this stuff and feel good about ourselves.
When you look at what is the solutions that are recommended for sort of attenuating narcissism in children, in a culture, it always sort of boils down to two things, connection to humans, mm-hmm. to friends and family, and a stronger sense of belonging to a society, yeah. or to a community. And that's exactly what happens at the end of your book, where the end is quite a long list of things that we can do individually and collectively.
Yeah, there was some study recently that actually came out about how feeling part of a community is the key thing for people overcoming depression and all these, you know, other mental health problems. And I would say that for me, I mean, I'm not a therapist and I'm not a scientist and I've not done a degree in this, but my gut feeling is that all of these different words, you know, like narcissism and this and that and the other, to me it's all the same thing. It's not feeling very good about yourself and developing maybe unhealthy coping mechanisms, and a lot of the time to do with validation. There's a great book, Facing Codependence, by Pia Melody, and she talks about lack of boundaries and inability to express ourselves appropriately. So it's either like, might be someone going into someone who maybe can't open up about their feelings with the friends and family, but then going to supermarket and the cashier says, how are you today? And you go, oh, I'm terrible, I'm having a terrible day, and my partner's left me and I feel awful and I'm fat and I'm ugly, and I'm, you know, that would be an issue of boundaries and expressing yourself. So all of these things, we often traumatize people, gay and straight. It's this kind of place where you think, I don't feel very good about myself, so I'm never going to speak to anyone else again. Everyone else is awful. I'm better than everyone else.
Often, and everything becomes about you. That everything, slammed door.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm angry. I'm blaming everyone. No one's good enough. Sometimes a very common thing is to feel worse than everybody at the same time as you feel better than everybody, which is a really confusing place to be in. And you isolate
quite common
yourself
in the performing arts.
Absolutely, yeah, completely. And then isolating yourself, when in fact what you need to do is go out and start engaging with people, which is why I really recommend 12-step groups so much, which they aren't very well accepted by the medical community because there's an element of spirituality to them. But they're really important because you can go whenever you need them, and actually you listen to other people. And if you keep going back week in, week out, you get to know those people and you get to know their stories. So in that hour or 90 minutes that you're in those meetings, you stop obsessing about yourself. Am I enough? Am I good enough? Am I job? Am I attractive enough? Am I this? Am I that? You start thinking about other people's problems without even knowing you're doing it, and it just brings your anxiety down and it enables you to deal with some of those other issues underneath. So connecting, it's the thing for the whole world, isn't it? You know, if we all felt more connected, you know, if you care about someone and relate to somebody, it's much more difficult to treat them badly. So
I just wanted to end with a quote from your book. Which to me sums it up and is also just extraordinarily beautiful, where you say, all of us, not just gay people, have been sold a pup. Life is not about being the best at school, about beating people, winning races, or getting the best marks at university. It's not about being the best looking, or hearts for shirtless selfies, or sleeping with the hottest people, or getting the best job, or being on guest lists for clubs, or hanging with cool people who aren't really cool, because how can they be when cool doesn't actually exist? No, life is about coming to terms with who you are, dealing with your demons, and enabling yourself to love and be loved. There really is nothing else to it.
Yeah, well, it says it all really, doesn't it? You know, I grew up thinking I needed to be Madonna. I needed to be a famous actor, and then I needed to be Madonna, and I needed to be in The Phantom of the Opera. And if I couldn't do those things, there'd be no point in living. And I've realised actually, the simple things I have are the most important things, you know, my family, my friends that I always had, and, you know, all these other things are great, but the real things that make me happy are those simple things. And unfortunately, we all have quite a journey to realising that, and a lot of people never do realise it. And I think it's the only way you can find real satisfaction. It is just all about love, really. And that people think that's wishy-washy, but it's not. I mean, I think it's a fundamental, it's like, you know, a law of physics. It's all just about love.
Our guest today was Matthew Todd, editor of Attitude magazine, author of Straitjacket, How to Be Gay and Happy, and also the occasional stand-up comedian. This has been a final episode of the Queer Season on Audio Stage. If you missed any of the conversations, you can always head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts from. In the meantime, if you like what we do, why not give us a rating on iTunes? It helps us reach more people that are interested in what we do. 2017 is an exciting year for Audio Stage. We will be back very soon with more in-depth conversations with creative minds from around the world.